Today's show is brought to you by FreshBooks. It's smart mobile accounting designed specifically for freelancers and small business owners. You can try FreshBooks for 30 days on us with no credit card required. Go to freshbooks.com/sports and enter sports in the How You Heard About Us section.
That's why it's important to build the team you want to build through the draft. It's all well and good that they threw a bunch of money at guys and got to be the team they envisioned, but now they can't keep their good players.
Quarterbacks, it's hard to maintain an extremely high level of play because you play such a reactionary position.
Welcome to the MMQB podcast. I'm Robert Mays. He's Andy Benoit. And Andy, today is tag day. Tag, you're it. Whatever you want to do with that. I mean, there are a million different names, but we can be super punny about this. But we have hit the salary cap time of the calendar. That's really the only thing going down outside of post-combine talk. So I think that's what we're going to get into first today. And then after that, we're going to do something pretty fun. We're both going to dig into our favorite draft picks of the last decade as a way to kind of start talking about some bigger draft issues, some strategies teams may employ. But first and foremost, we're going to get to the cap guys, and I believe we're going to start with the most important position, and that is quarterback.
Yeah, and the guy that got the cap or got the franchise tag was Kirk Cousins, and then the only out of franchise tag mode was probably Sam Bradford. Would you agree with the 2-year contract? That's like, I don't know if that's like the biggest news in the world, but that has a little bit of a domino effect, because anytime you have a starting quarterback get signed, that's going to impact multiple teams who need QBs.
Of course. I mean, and that'll impact a lot of the offseason decisions, and we'll get into whether or not that Sam Bradford move was a good one. But let's start with Cousins. Obviously, the franchise tag pays him a salary of about $19.35 million this year. It's the highest base salary for a quarterback in the NFL in 2016. Far from the highest cap hit. I mean, I think you have 8 or 9 guys over $20 million when you take bonuses into account. But we're going to hear often that Kirk Cousins has the highest base salary. People are going to say that as a, wow, look at how crazy this is. But is it really that crazy that Washington decided to do this?
No, not at all. Anything else would have been crazy, because this is just the nature of it. I understand how this came to be. Washington views this price tag as pretty hefty for a guy who really is a piece of the puzzle, not the driving force of the offense. And $19 million is a lot in their minds. And Kirk Cousins' camp, if the franchise tag begins there, then that's where your beginning place is for negotiating. So there was never any way for this to go other in any other direction without one side taking a severe gamble, and mainly Washington's side taking a gamble. Cousins hasn't been at it a whole lot. The sample size is still small with him, and that's such a highly manufactured offense that I don't want to say anyone could run it. But Cousins, again, he's a puzzle piece, and we could get into the details if you want. I don't know if people take umbrage with that or not. His numbers were very good, but that was because he played in such a very well-designed offense. So I'm not at all surprised that Washington's basically wanting to see one more year from him before they – you're going to have to give him big money anyway, right? Whenever you sign the QB, it's going to cost a lot. So why not kick the can down the road if you don't have a big sample size with the guy you're looking to sign?
I feel like we've gotten into a lot of the details. I mean, he has a lot of weapons to work with. Jay Gruden is a very good offensive coach. He was put in a lot of positions to succeed. Giving him about $20 million this year isn't that prohibitive if you're Washington. And that's exactly what it does. It kicks the can down the road and gives you another season to decide, do we want to hand this guy a very long-term contract? And when you're thinking of $20 million as a one-year investment in someone, of course that's expensive. But I think the other big piece of quarterback news that happened today, which we already touched on, really gives you some insight into the way the market currently exists. And that's with Sam Bradford getting 2 years and $36 million from the Eagles, with $26 million of that guaranteed. So for on a year-by-year basis, that's $18 million a season. We don't know exactly how it's structured yet, whether Philly can get out from under it under a year or what that situation's like. I assume they've given themselves that option. But just the numbers on their face, really gives you a look at how much quarterbacks cost. And I think that contract gives you a little bit more comfort if you're Washington making the decision that you made.
Yeah, again, quarterbacks, and that, those are big numbers for Bradford. I'm frankly surprised by the size of them. I mean, $26 million guaranteed. So that's $7 million. I know it's spread out over 2 years, but that's $7 million more than franchising him would have cost. And it's easier to spread it out over 2 years for cap purposes. That's a lot of – let me ask you this, Mays. Has any quarterback in recent history made more money on – potential and circumstance of need for the team he joined than Sam Bradford? He got paid huge money as the number one pick in St. Louis, which obviously that's potential that you're investing in if you're the Rams and you have a dire need because that's why you're picking number one. And then to me, Philadelphia here is looking around and seeing a pretty depleted QB market, which is always the case. They're not drafting in a position to get Wentz or Jared Goff. So they have no choice. So they have to pay a premium to avoid having a backup wedged into the starting lineup. So again, Sam Bradford benefits from circumstances and almost potential, because if they're paying him this much for what he did last year, then they're fools. They're paying him this much for what they hope he can become in Doug Peterson's offense.
I think potential plays a part of it. Potential plays a part, especially when with where he was drafted. I mean, he was the number one pick in the draft coming off an injury. I mean, that's just proof that they really thought he had a chance to be something special in St. Louis. But then I think more than that, when you look at the next, just overall, the amount of money that guy has made, when you look at it on the whole, it's more a matter of circumstance than it is a potential. He's the number one pick in the last draft before the new CBA, where the top two or three picks just get paid an exorbitant amount of money. So that's the first part of the circumstantial stuff. And then you got into the second part. We're entering this era where there's such a dearth of quarterback talent and there's so few guys that you feel really solid about starting that just having a guy like Sam Bradford where it's been on display and it's not god-awful, it's just not worth inspiring enthusiasm, that's better than the unknown at this point. That's where we are with quarterback options. So that's what he's done. Twice in his career, when it's been time to cash in a little bit, he's been the number one pick in the last draft of the old CBA, and he's been a guy hitting free agency at a time where quarterback play is probably in the biggest valley it has been in recent memory. So the guy has really done a good job for himself in just being alive at the right times.
And both of these deals we've touched on here, Cousins and Bradford, really speak to the inherent value at quarterback. This is what the market says the position is worth, because there are 20 other quarterbacks in the NFL that are clearly better than Bradford right now, and there are probably 18 to 20 that are clearly better than Kirk Cousins. So this is what these guys cost. That's what a quarterback costs. You're not going to go out and ever find a deal on a quarterback. Even on a one-year contract, you're almost guaranteed to not get a great bang for your buck. You're going to have to spend the money. Quarterbacks are one of those things that just cost what they cost. And by the way, Philadelphia, as Washington, we said they're a highly manufactured offense, a well put together system. If Doug Peterson runs what he learned under Andy Reid in Kansas City, and from what I've heard, that will be the case, although they've got two other coordinators from last year on the staff, and Frank Reich and John DeFilippo, who's now the QB coach. So that's three offensive minds coming together in one output. But if they run that system that was run in Kansas City, then you don't need a superstar QB for that either. You just need a very reliable, even cautious type of quarterback like Alex Smith there in Kansas City.
You mentioned something interesting. You said that there are probably 20 quarterbacks better than Sam Bradford. The only thing you don't want to be right now is one of those teams with one of the four worst quarterbacks. That's what the last thing you want to be. As long as you can stay out of there, you're willing to pay up a little bit, which I think is very interesting. And as we continue kind of on the quarterback value conversation, Brock Osweiler is another name that comes to mind. And where Brock Osweiler is going to go and how much he's going to be worth is impacted by one of these other franchise tag decisions. We thought Von Miller was going to get tagged. He did get tagged. Not a surprise. Not a lot to talk about there with Miller. They obviously want him long term. They're going to try to figure that out. This more just has ramifications across the rest of the Bronco roster, because now you have to consider what's going to happen with Osweiler. Where is Malik Jackson going to go? You assume he's probably just gone. So I guess that's what I'll ask you first. What do you think is going to happen with Brock Osweiler, your gut feeling?
I think he'll re-sign with Denver. I think he'll get more money than we would expect because there will be a few other teams bidding for him. When quarterbacks reach quarterback bargains, again, you can't really find a bargain, but the favorable contracts, the guys like Kaepernick, Dalton, Tannehill, where they signed deals that the team could wiggle out of and the guaranteed money wasn't outrageous, those are all contracts that come when the guys had more years left on their remaining deal. So none of those deals were signed in the open market where other teams were bidding. Mm-hmm. If other teams are getting involved on the bidding, then the price will go up, the incentives, all the little bonus stuff, the guaranteed money, it's going to be structured very favorably for the quarterback. So it hurts Denver not to have this done, but I don't think they had much of a choice, because if they hadn't tagged Miller, then they probably would have tagged Malik Jackson anyway. At least that's the sense I got. I could be wrong. But they're going to wind up having to pay off. They're going to have to make a decision on Osweiler now, probably a little sooner than they were hoping to make a decision. But, you know, that's the way it goes. And if they feel unsettled about that, they can remind themselves that they're coming off a Super Bowl, and these things tend to happen to teams coming off a Super Bowl.
Does them not tagging Osweiler and letting him have the chance to walk away give you a little bit more of a sense of what may happen with Peyton Manning? Just the idea that they can't afford to pay $38 million to their quarterbacks even for a week. So the idea of tagging Osweiler and paying Peyton Manning $19 million is just untenable. Does this give you a little bit more of a sense that he may be leaning toward coming back?
Does it give you that sense?
I don't know. Maybe a little bit. I don't know. Schefter reported today that he wants to play. I don't know. It's... This is a tough spot. Well, if you're Denver, you just have to ask him to go away. I know it's a tough thing to do, but you can't move on. You can't make your choices until you make a decision on him. I know that they don't want to rush him, but you got to rush him.
I'm a film guy, and so watching, I go back to the film, and I don't want to get overly caught up in all of these numbers and all the ancillary stuff. It starts on the football field, and Peyton Manning on the football field looked washed up this season. He just did. Now, he won a title looking washed up, which I give all the credit in the world to him for that. Washed up is still washed up. So he was so unlike himself over the course of the year that I have never considered the idea of him coming back. I just figure if he does come back, I'll just invest all my energy in being totally blown away and shocked and overwhelmed with unexpectedness. I would be, and that's how I would feel if he comes back. I don't think he can play the way he needs to play anymore to be an NFL QB. So I don't think he'll be back for the reason that he can't play.
I mean, I tend to agree with you. I just think that Elway is saying last week that they weren't on an accelerated timeline and they were going to give him some time. Free agency starts in 9 days, 8 days. 8 days from when we're recording this, 7 days from when it's actually going to run. I mean, it's coming, man. Like, you need to start having your ducks in a row to decide how you're going to spend your money, and that's $19 million tied up in that quarterback that you don't want on your team anymore. So,
well, we're assuming they don't want him, but
I want a proverbial you. I'm talking about proverbial you. You as the caricature of a decision maker do not want Peyton Manning on your team right now.
No, you don't. And the only way they could justify having Manning back, it would be a two-part equation. One is they'd have to feel that he's right now head-to-head better than Osweiler. And they could feel that, because
if that's a two-part equation, we're not getting the first part.
You don't think he's better than Osweiler, but we're talking about Denver. I don't think he necessarily is either right now, although I thought it was the right decision in the heat of the season, in the flow of the season, to go back to Manning and start him. But if we're adding a few more months now of offseason, and presumably Osweiler gets better in some capacity, you know, I don't think Manning's a better option heading into next year either. But it's possible, Mays, that Denver thinks he is, because they just decided on him over Osweiler at the end of last season. So they'd be feeling like that. And then the other part is they wouldn't be sold on Osweiler long term. They'd be very much 50-50 on, well, is he an answer for us in the next 5 years? And if you're 50-50 about that, then you needed to sign him to a team-friendly deal before he became an unrestricted free agent, because you're not going to, like we just said, you're not going to get that team-friendly deal now.
It'll be fascinating to see what they do. I mean, it's just that, God, giving $19 million to Manning puts you in such a tough spot. And it's going to be hard for me to imagine them wanting to do that. But let's move on. We can talk about this for way too long. The other guy that was pretty much a no-brainer getting the franchise tag was Josh Norman. I don't know what else to say about this. I mean, he's going to get a really nice chunk of change. I mean, his deal is going to be about $14 million, which is the one-year deal for a cornerback. It's doable for them on a one-year situation. They have some stuff to figure out. I can't imagine that Charles Johnson is going to be on that team at $15 million. That saves them $11. They don't really have a ton of other cost-cutting moves to make, and they're about $9 million under the cap right now. So that's their big one, and then maybe they give Norman slightly less salary this year. They push it back a little bit as they figure everything else out. This is a team in an interesting money situation because they have their two big guys locked down. The Cam contract has already been signed. The Kuechly contract has already been signed. They've done those two. But they also have some young guys coming up. They're going to need to get paid eventually. So you can't really discount what that is going to mean. You have your Kawan Short deal, your Star Lotulelei deal. Trey Turner's going to need to get paid eventually. So they have deals looming, and I think that's probably why you have a little bit of pause about how much you can pay Norman. In the end, I feel like there's no way he gets out. Dave Gettleman said last week that they weren't in the business of drafting and developing players for other teams, which I understand that sentiment.
Yeah, and I like the way he words that too. We forget that is what happens sometimes with these guys that escape to free agency. I'll tell you this, they're not equipped to, I mean, they're not set up to pay a guy like Josh Norman with the way they've done business and the way they've allocated money before. You said Short, Star Lotulelei, those are the guys they pay. They pay defensive linemen and linebackers because they run this somewhat vanilla zone-based scheme that's not just a zone scheme, but also one that has really good intermediate defenders in Kuechly and Davis. And what happens when you've got those linebackers with that kind of speed and awareness, they play with greater depth and coverage, which shrinks the zone windows that the back guys, the cornerbacks, the safeties, it shrinks the windows that they must defend. So not only do you have an easier scheme, because zone coverage is easier than man-to-man, but you've got an easier than usual zone coverage scheme. So that's why they could sign a Charles Tillman or a Roman Harper or a Kurt Coleman, guys that were cut from previous rosters or not retained at the end of their career, guys that don't run particularly well. This team doesn't really need star corners. Now, Norman was immensely important for him last year, and he might be so good in what he does, the exception to the rule, that they'll have to find a way to bend their principles for him. But I think long-term, if they want to get Norman long-term, that will present some problems for him. And they can delay it this year. They've been able to give him the franchise tag. But we're going to have Josh Norman discussions a year from now. And by the way, just history says it's very unlikely that he's going to be as good next season as he was this season. Cornerbacks, it's hard to maintain an extremely high level of play because you play such a reactionary position. You're not in control of things. If you're a corner, you have to react to receivers and to footballs thrown in the air.
And I agree with that. And this is what you've seen from this team a little bit in the last couple of years. So they draft Kona Ealy when it seems like they have two defensive ends. But then we see when, as soon as Kona Ealy is ready to play full time, is when what's his name? The one I don't like, Greg Hardy's already out of here. And then Charles
Johnson. You don't like Greg Hardy? What do you got against Greg Hardy?
Not a thing. He's a stand-up guy.
Yeah.
And then Charles Johnson's probably played himself out price-wise. So they draft what seems like a position of strength, but in reality, they're planning for the future. And I feel like you could see that again this year. You know, they draft Shaq Thompson last year. Obviously, even though I love Thomas Davis like he's a member of my family, he's probably on the way out sooner rather than later. And I think we may see the same thing again. I could see them drafting a corner, maybe even two this season, while planning on them maybe not being able to retain Josh Norman next year.
Yeah, and look at where they – and here's how we know. Look where they drafted guys you just talked about. Shaq Thompson, even though they didn't need an outside linebacker, they took him in the first round this year. Ealy, they took in the second round without needing a guy at that position. The guys, Bene Benwickery, the corner who they drafted in 2014, they got in round five. In that same year, they got Trey Boston, the safety, in round four. So teams tell you how they feel by who they draft and where. And Carolina's MO is so plain to see. They're a front seven-based defense. And now they're in a position where they have to pay big money to a cornerback. So it will be interesting to see. And I agree with you about Thomas Davis too, although I kind of thought Davis would be near the end 2 or 3 years ago. He's almost like Terrell Suggs, one of those guys I've just decided I'd rather be wrong 1 year rather than 3 or 4 more years. And so I'm going to just keep betting on him now because he proved me wrong the last couple of years.
That's a really good point. And before we move on, which we absolutely should, that's very interesting what you just said, because I'm literally staring at their depth chart right now. And when you look at their depth chart, it goes front seven to the back end. So the top guy is Charles Johnson, which he was a third round pick, but he was the highest paid defensive end in the league. So they clearly value him. So then you go down the rest of it. Star Latuile, first round pick. K'Wan Short, second round pick. Coney Ealy, second round pick. Shaq Thompson, first round pick. Luke Kuechly, first round pick. Thomas Davis, first round pick. Now let's go to the secondary. B'nai Ben-Wickery, fifth round pick. Roman Harper, cut. Kurt Coleman, unrestricted. Josh Norman, fifth round pick. So there's such a delineation there, and you can see it visually, which it's very interesting that you said that. All right, let's move on.
Yeah, that's never an accident. Where teams pick guys is never an accident.
So let's move on to the other guy that was probably expected. I mean, just based on the cap situation his team is in, and that's Muhammad Wilkerson. So the Jets, we think of them as this team with all this cap room, but that didn't last very long because they spent it all. So, I mean, right now, they're more up against it than you probably thought they would be, just based on the amount of spending they've done in the last couple years. Obviously, a big chunk of that spending had to do with big ticket items. You know, Darrell Revis having to pay Brandon Marshall what he was worth, Eric Decker. But then you go down the line, they played Breno Giacomini, who's making 5.6 this year. Marcus Gilchrist making the exact same. James Carpenter's making 5.75. Buster Screen is at 7.7. And the David Harris contract, which is 7.5, and it's all guaranteed this year, is awful. But the mid-tier of contracts this team has really put them in a cash-strapped spot, and that is why it's really hard for them to want to give a guy like Muhammad Wilkerson, who is an all-pro level player, a long-term deal. So they have to slab him with a franchise tag that's worth $15.7 million.
Yeah, I don't know if they would feel – I think that makes perfect sense. I agree with all the analysis, and maybe they've got – maybe it's a case of they're just kicking the can with Wilkerson as well. My guess is they don't feel too concerned about being tied financially right now because they've got guys doing jobs they want done. Clearly, they want to have a big offensive line. And clearly, we know this, with Todd Bowles, he wants guys who can cover, and he wants versatile safeties. And Screen's a slot corner cover guy, and that's hard to find. And Gilchrist is one of the most versatile safeties in the league. So they've got the guys to play the kind of football they want. I think the one thing they have to decide or have to get figured out is how do you get Ryan Fitzpatrick retained? Because this is a team that, what did they win, 9-10 games a year ago, right?
I think they won 9, yeah. They were right on the brink of the playoffs. They'd won that last game, they would have been in.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a team that's in position to – I think they're right where they want to be. They probably would like to have a franchise QB, any team would. But for the way they're built and what they inherited and started out with, I think they're in a decent spot to play the kind of football that Todd Bowles wants to play.
Well, that's true, but the way they had to get there is – that's the problem with building that way. By having to get to that position by spending a ton of money in free agency, you get to a spot where you can't re-sign the really good players you draft. That's why it's important to build the team you want to build through the draft and not with free agent money. It's all well and good that they threw a bunch of money at guys and got to be the team they envisioned, but now they can't keep their good players.
Yeah. No, I get what you're saying, but so of their free agents now, besides nose tackle Damon Harrison, who are the ones, and we touched on Fitzpatrick, let's say they figure out something with him. I don't know how they would do it. Let's say they do, though, because I my guess is he doesn't want to leave because he's traveled around so much, and now he's found a system that he's comfortable in, a team that can win, probably a decent place to live. So I bet he wants to resign there. Who else do they have, though, this year that's hurting them for free agency?
Muhammad Wilkerson. The fact that they have to put the franchise tag on him and can't give him a deal.
Well, but yeah, I I get it. I guess what are your general feelings about the franchise tag? Do you like it when teams use it or dislike it? Because I kind of like the franchise tag from the players don't like it, but I like it from the team side of things. Well, anytime you can buy time with a star. Well, so what's wrong with tagging Wilkerson?
Well, because it'd be nice to have him on a long-term deal, because it's not as if they have a ton of moves next year. They can cut DeBrickashaw Ferguson next season and save $13 million. Then you're out of a left tackle, which is really fun. I mean, everyone loves that life. So, and cutting David Harris next year is an option. So they're going to be able to free up some money. But it's still never fun to envision a reality and to be placed in a reality where you don't have your stars long term. I mean, if Wilkerson gets to free agency next year and they don't want to tag him again and you risk losing him, that's not fun.
I see what you're saying. So you're concerned about the future more.
Yes.
And I'm looking more at the immediate. Yeah. I mean, I think, I don't disagree with you. I think just from the 30,000 foot level, Mohamed Wilkerson's only 26. He'll be 27 when the next season kicks off, which means that teams will view him as a 28-year-old heading into free agency next year. So that's not young, but that's probably not too old to impact his contract. He'll probably be a marquee free agent if he gets there next year. But just from the 30,000 foot level, what's wrong with biding your time with a superstar, getting him on a relatively friendly deal? I know these franchise tags are expensive, but so is at some point these guys all become expensive. I mean, if you sign Ndamukong Suh in free agency like Miami did a year ago, he's becoming extremely expensive this year. At some point,
franchise tag
every marquee
expensive.
Free agent costs.
Any one-year deal in the NFL is not expensive. We're talking expensive in the grand
scheme. Well, then,
so
why would you not want Wilkerson then on a not expensive deal? Why wouldn't you take that for one more year? And who knows? You never want a guy to get hurt, but if he does, then you're not having to pay him. I mean, there's so many things that can go wrong.
See, I understand. We're getting into a bigger conversation here. I mean, but this is why the franchise tag is bullshit. I mean, go ahead and bleep me. It is unfair, and it's just it depresses the market for players in a way that is totally antithetical to the way people should be paid for their services, and it really upsets me. So if we want to get into that conversation, we can. But I mean, it's the fact that he's not going to be a free agent now until he's 28. That's just crap. So I think that from that perspective, and that you do run the risk of losing him eventually, it's never the ideal scenario to have to use it.
Well, I get that. I see why someone would feel it's crap, the franchise tag. Bottom line is the NFLPA got beat in the labor negotiations. NFL owners had more leverage. Billionaires have a thousand times more money than millionaires. And so this is the system that played out. So, I mean, it's crap, but you can understand why the league wanted to do it. Because imagine we've got the top nine.
Of course you can.
Well, yeah, imagine if these guys – would the league really be that much fun if nine of the top free agents every year, like this year we'd have, were just changing teams?
Yes,
I mean, if guys
it would be amazing.
No.
It would make free agency fascinating. Oh, my God, I totally disagree with you. It would make free agency the best week of every single NFL season.
No, Mays. It would be such short-lived. I mean, remember –
Oh my God!
It's ephemeral. It's very temporary fun. It's better for fans. It's better in the big picture of the NFL to have guys like Mohamed Wilkerson, bona fide star players, be with the same team for 7 or 8 years to give teams an identity. To give fans, they'd probably buy more jerseys actually if guys were trading teams a lot. But to give fans guys the jerseys they can really match up to, jerseys they can feel like this is our own. I mean, imagine if guys like Junior Seau had moved around early in his career away from the Chargers, or, you know, if a quarterback, heaven forbid, ever got away, a superstar quarterback. I don't think that'd be good for the league in the big picture of things.
I totally disagree. I think of this in the NFL sense, where the idea of where Kevin Durant is going next year has been never-ending conversation. And that would be how the NFL worked. If you had an absolute superstar, you knew he was hitting free agency, it would keep the league in the conversation, in the national sports conversation, even more so than it is now. Just because the fodder would be never ending. I would absolutely
But the fodder, at some point, that fodder takes away from what's happening on the field. That's you just said Kevin Durant. The NBA's heating up for a playoff run in one of its greatest seasons of all time. Why do you want Kevin Durant being where he's going next year? Why do you want that to be a big story? Why not have – wouldn't you want any talk of the NBA to be on the court if you're the NBA?
Kevin Durant maybe leaving took away nothing from how awesome that game was on Saturday between the Thunder and the Warriors. I was not less excited about that basketball game because Kevin Durant may not be on the Thunder next year.
But it's less talked about, though. You can't talk about two things at once. So if you're talking NBA and you're talking Kevin Durant leaving, that means you're not talking Steph Curry in that moment. And I think for the
I was talking about Steph Curry in that moment. Because eventually
you're talking about you can't. You're either talking Durant or you're talking Curry. You can't be saying two things at the exact same time. So that's anytime you talk off court, you're taking away from on court. It's the same with the NFL. You don't want the NFL's got the best sport there is. It's the most strategic base. It takes the most unique kind of talent. Well, maybe not that, but the most unique collection of talent with the number of bodies on there, and it has the most personalities because of all that. Especially if you count coaches. Why not try to keep all the focus as much as possible on what happens on the field rather than what happens in the negotiating room where people really don't completely understand the nuances of it anyway.
Well, I also just think that the players should have more power. And this would give the players more power. I understand why they don't have it, but in an ideal world, they would have a little bit more. And I want them to have that. I want them to have the power to change teams if they'd like that. And I also think it would be fun. But we have to move on because if we don't move on, we're going to talk about this forever, and there's other stuff we have to get to.
Like Olivier Vernon, who a guy – now that's one – that's a D-end I could understand leaving, and it would not, like, tear my heart out the way Muhammad Wilkerson leaving the Jets would.
I agree with you. And so here's the thing. I think there's one of two scenarios that will play out with Olivier Vernon and the Dolphins. The first one is that they let him leave. The second one is that they cut Cameron Wake and save $8.4 million. And then keep Vernon. Because if they cut Wake and save the money, there's no possible way they can let Vernon go. Because then your pass rush outside of Ndamukong Suh just doesn't exist. From a football perspective, it would just be kind of irresponsible. But they just don't have the money to work with. After tagging Vernon, they have negative $3 million in cap space. So they have to do something. And they just don't have that many options. It's either Wake, $4 million for Greg Jennings, which would make sense, or $7.5 million if they cut Jordan Cameron, which you could live
with. $4 million in savings on Jennings, you mean? $4 million in savings?
Yep.
Yeah, he'll be gone. Yeah, they'll do that. They would do that.
So, but those aren't huge deals. I mean, they have a lot of depth at receiver. I mean, you have Jarvis Landry. I think Rashard Matthews is a free agent. But then you have Jarvis Landry, the Devontae Parker, the guy they picked in the first round last year. You have Kenny Stills, who I think is still alive. It's unclear. And that's about it, though. I mean, those are their three guys.
They don't have a lot of weapons. And the other thing is that they have a bad secondary. They're very limited.
Very bad.
Brent Grimes is – yeah, I mean, it's probably the worst in the league. Brent Grimes is not a number one anymore. He still can play, but not the way they need him to. Bobby McCain is the nickel guy with Jamar Taylor. I mean, guys that really haven't panned out yet. It's probably early to say that on McCain. He's a fifth round pick last year, but he would not be a number two or three on very many teams. So they have a bad secondary, and unlike the Panthers, they don't necessarily have a scheme that allows for bad secondary play. In fact, Vance Joseph is who they hired. He came over as the DB coach from Cincinnati. He's now their D coordinator. Presumably, he's going to run a lot of those Bengals type, Mike Zimmer type concepts that Zimmer installed years ago there. And that's a zone scheme, but not the same way that Carolina's is. And if you see Cincinnati, they have Reggie Nelson, who was once a first-round pick, and they draft a corner in the first round about every other year with Leon Hall or Dennard or Dre Kirkpatrick. They had Jonathan Joseph years ago. So it's not a defensive scheme equipped to play with the kind of guys they have, which might be one reason Vernon gets away from them too is the problem now, Mays, is you've got an owner, and I say Vernon gets away because maybe they think, okay, we tough it out for a year or two and we have to rebuild some of this from the ground up. The problem is you've got an owner that has already publicly said they have a three-year chance here, three-year window to get better, and if it's not working by then, we change in coaches, which I think is a ridiculous mindset and an even more ridiculous thing to say publicly.
It's not that great of a situation. I think the corner spot that they're in, they can fix in the draft early. They're in a spot that's high enough. They have the eighth pick where there's likely going to be a cornerback in that range that you can plug in and play with Grimes. So hopefully you fix that there. But they also just have plenty of holes elsewhere. Their linebacking situation is not good. Their offensive line could probably use some upgrades. Juwan James is going to be back this year. He was hurt for most of last season. He's a guy they picked in the first round a couple years ago. So you'd hope that'll be a little bit better. But they have a ton of holes. And letting Vernon get away and losing one of the only really good players that you have, that's tough to stomach. And but that's when you pay Ndamukong Suh that much money, here are the ramifications. This is the reality of the salary cap.
You know, I think your suggestion of cutting Cameron Wake is probably a good move. Now, they would, they could afford to do that. I'm looking at, you already said that, $8.4 million in savings. It'd be $1.4 of dead money from that. But Wake is coming off of an Achilles injury, and that's a problem for a small, older guy. He's not old, but he's older, and he's undersized. You
he's
need
pretty
that
old,
explosiveness.
Man.
What's his age?
I think he's 33.
Because he played in this. He's 34. You're right. Yeah. I mean, he played in the CFL. He hasn't looked old to me yet, but I think that will change this season when if he's coming. I mean, it's just 34-year-old coming off an Achilles. He's a speed rushing end. Even if they don't get Olivier Vernon back, I think they probably need to move on from Cameron Wake just because of the cost that he brings for him.
Pour one out because he's been one of my favorite players the last 5 years. I love watching
him.
He's
had a nice career. He's had a very nice career, and hopefully it can continue somewhere. Maybe it's – I mean, Robert Mathis is a good example. In fact, they're similar sizes. Mathis came off the Achilles. He came back slowly from it, and that was the smart thing to do because he looked as explosive as usual last season, just playing fewer snaps. So I wouldn't write Cameron Wake off, but at the cost that he is for them and given their other circumstances around Miami, I would probably move on from him and let somebody else benefit if they want to take the Robert Mathis gamble on him.
Let's move on to a team that makes the Dolphins look fiscally responsible, and that's the Buffalo Bills, who have by far the worst cap situation in the NFL. It is horrendously bad. They had to make two cuts today to put themselves a gentleman's, I believe, $1 million under the salary cap. They are $1.5 million under the cap, and that is after cutting Mario Williams, which saves them about $12.9 million, and cutting Craig Urbick. I don't know how much that saves them because I didn't look it up. But that's where we are with the Bills. They don't have much money. They have to make big moves to get themselves in a position to even retain guys on the tag. And with Glenn, it's kind of a deal where you just can't afford to lose him. The way they play offensively, we talked about this. You just can't let Tyrod Taylor run out there with any left tackle.
Yeah, you're right. Cordy Glenn, their left tackle, is a guy they franchise tagged. They got to figure out Richie Incognito at left guard. It sounds like that he and the team are at an impasse right now, and he's a free agent. I agree. I don't think left tackles are worth the amount of money they command in the NFL. We've talked about that. But there are exceptions, and one of them would absolutely be Buffalo because of the way their quarterback plays. He's not an anticipation passer at all. He very much has to see it. And if you're a see it, you got to see the guy get open. It takes that much longer to do that. So having a left tackle. Cordy Glenn's a unique player because I've watched him. I've probably seen 90% of his games since he came into the league, and he almost never shows up in my film notes, positive or negative. He just doesn't show up. And I think that's a positive given the position he plays and the surroundings around him. So I understand the decision to franchise tag him here in this case. I get that one because you need to protect Tyrod Taylor.
And they have a couple more moves to make, but not many. The only cut they can make that would save them more than $2.5 million while costing them less than $1 million in dead money is Manny Lawson. He's the only one. Most of the cuts they would have to make would involve a decent amount of dead money and not a ton of savings. So they don't have that many pieces of tinkering to do. One of them that they can do, which is actually kind of interesting, is they're restructuring Charles Clay's deal right now, who counts about $13 million against the cap. And the reason he does that is because when they gave him the transition tag in Miami, the Bills structured his deal as such that they really tried to ding the Dolphins if they wanted to bring him back by pumping up his cap number this year, which I guess is all like well and good if you're trying to do like contract espionage against a division rival, but now it's making you face really hard decisions when it comes to signing your own guys.
Yeah, it is. Clay was at the very top of Greg Roman's wish list, though, offensive coordinator for the Bills. So I think they were willing to live with that. They need to use him in a more expansive way this season, by the way. Antonio Cromartie visited this team the other day. Can you figure out where they would play him? He absolutely cannot be a safety because he doesn't tackle anybody. So you'd need to play him at corner. He doesn't play the slot, so you'd need to play him outside. He's not better than Darby or Gilmore, the current starters outside. He certainly would not be better than Roby in the slot, and he's probably not as good as Leodis McKelvin, who only costs $3 million and is their number four corner. So where would he, and Ron Brooks, a fourth-round pick, who I guess is a free agent, they probably won't re-sign him, but he's been their number five corner, so they've been deep there at the position. Where would he play if he joined the Bills?
Well, they can save a little money if they cut McKelvin.
Not a ton. And I mean, okay, if they cut McKelvin, they would save $3.9 million. Let's say they sign Cromartie for $2 million. So you're saving $1.9 million. Maybe that's what they're looking to
do. Hey, man, when you're this team, that $1.9 million is a hell of a lot of money.
Yeah, maybe it is. Maybe that's the plan. Cromartie shouldn't do that, though, and I don't think he will, because he's still good enough to start for most teams. He's not good enough to play on this one, but he wasn't worth what I think he's getting over $4 million this year from the Jets. He's not quite worth big money anymore, but he's still a quality NFL starter. Someone else will pay Cromartie money.
All right, let's move on, because we got to breeze through these last few. The Bears franchise tag Alshon Jeffery. I don't understand why. The Bears have all the cap space, but I guess Alshon wanted a ton of money. Is there any way you could explain this in less than 10 seconds?
Yeah, it's the same thing as Muhammad Wilkerson. You've got and especially in this case, you've got a guy that's been injury prone the last few years. So why not get a 1-year deal and then make him prove it again? You never know what's going to happen with these guys. The more you can delay the super long-term contract, the better off for the team.
I don't disagree with you, even though it saddens my heart to not disagree with you, because I would like to see him be a Bear and not get away. He's a profoundly talented player, but he really hasn't been on the field enough to warrant a massive deal, and I am assuming that's what his agent is starting with. Eric Berry is another guy. The Chiefs are in a better cap situation than they have been recently, but they still don't have a ton of money. They also have a few really big cap hits looming next year. You have Houston at 20.6, Smith at 19.6, Maccon at 12.4. So I imagine that they're wanting to put off signing Berry, but it'd be hard to see him getting away from there, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it would be hard, because he's not only, I mean, besides the personal or emotional side of it, which I think matters a little bit, he fits what they do extremely well. They need versatility and depth at the safety position, and he provides that versatility and indirectly provides the depth, because if he's your number one, it means better guys are at two and three most likely. So I get the decision to keep Berry, and I think it's the right one for him. He gets to play in the same place that he's played. In a right run for him, I mean, to sign a long-term deal there at some point with this team, assuming they can get numbers worked out, because he's in the same place. It's a scheme that fits him extremely well. And he's really amazed. I think he's become kind of the face of that franchise.
That's really interesting. I don't necessarily disagree. I mean, you could probably say that. Just to wrap it up with Eric Berry, though, I feel like if you overcome cancer, you should have a clause in your contract that doesn't allow you to be franchise tagged. I think as a human race, we should be able to come to that conclusion together.
I tip my cap to him. Now, how about this? If someone had went to Eric Berry in the middle of his chemotherapy a year ago and said, hey, you're going to get the franchise tag next year, which will be over $10 million, he probably would have taken that, though, don't you think? I mean, let's also – this is an accomplishment for Eric Berry as well, because I don't think they expected him to play football this soon. Yeah.
I get what you're saying. There's no doubt in its accomplishment, but the accomplishment that he had should pay him much more than $10 million in the aggregate. But let's move on. One last guy, Trumaine Johnson, who is definitely the smallest name on this list. I mean, the guy that the least amount of NFL fans know. Are you at all surprised that he is one of the guys that got the non-exclusive tag?
No, I'm not, because speaking with people around the Rams this past week at the Combine, I was given the impression that in some ways they feel their corners are the most valuable guys on their defense because of all the different things that Greg Williams does. They really like – yeah, I know. That's what I said, but they really, really value their corners there in Los Angeles.
And, cool. I value Aaron Donald.
Yeah, no, I value Donald's. Well, I think they, you know, Donald's young and they like the guys that can play man coverage because then theoretically they can do whatever they want schematically. I'd take Aaron Donald as well. I just know they love their corners. They think higher of their corners than I think people outside the organization would think. So it doesn't surprise me they signed Tremaine Johnson. And it wouldn't surprise me if they found a way to retain Janoris Jenkins. How much cap space do they have there in St. Louis? Do you know?
All of the cap space. They have it all.
They're let me, good. All right.
Let me look up what it actually is. It's a lot. It is a ton. Right now, as it currently stands, even after tagging Johnson, they have $45 million in cap space.
Funny how teams that have no quarterback and no offensive weapons other than the running back who's on a rookie deal. Funny how they've got all that cap space available. So they need to bring some guys in. I bet they re-signed Jenkins then, and they'll have to find someone else. And the other thing, did we ever talk about Laurinaitis leaving? I think we did last week, right?
Yeah, we did. We did talk about him leaving already.
They're going to put Ogletree at middle linebacker. I just find that fascinating. I think
we speculated on that, though. We predicted that before they said it. Good job by us.
Yeah, no, we're geniuses. But I think that'll be an interesting one because it kind of ties into these cornerbacks because they do so many different things schematically because they feel comfortable playing man coverage. But when you do a lot of things, you've got to have someone on the field setting that up and organizing it. And Ogletree's young. He's not known as a communicator. And Laurinaitis, the strength of his game was pre-snap awareness. So in some ways, if Laurinaitis is gone, you could argue it has depleted the value, or not depleted, but diminished the value of Tremaine Johnson and Janoris Jenkins, because ultimately they might wind up becoming a simpler defense anyway, which wouldn't be the worst thing. They've got speed and talent. You can play simple if you have that.
I want to get into this with you, but we just don't have the time because we have to get to another topic of conversation, which is one thing that I don't enjoy. I feel like you don't enjoy. And one of the reasons that it's been a little bit of a challenge is because I'm a freelancer when it comes to Sports Illustrated. And that, when it comes to tax season, is really going to throw a wrench into some stuff. It's not going to be the plug and play situation it's been for me in the last few years. The good news for us and the good news for people in similar situations is that now, for the best way to manage your books and make tax season easy, you can get FreshBooks, a super intuitive tool that makes creating and sending invoices extremely simple for freelancers and small business owners. FreshBooks stands out where it really counts, getting you paid. You can create and send professional invoices in just 30 seconds. You'll see exactly where your client looked at the invoice you've emailed, tracking the status of all the outstanding invoices for you. FreshBooks can even send late payment reminders to your clients automatically, which means you're not wasting time chasing down and fighting clients for payments. The results speak for themselves. FreshBooks users get paid 5 days faster on average. Don't just take my word for it. Right now, FreshBooks is offering our listeners 30 days of unrestricted use, totally free, and you don't need a credit card to sign up. Just go to freshbooks.com/sports and enter sports in the how you heard about us section. That's freshbooks.com/sports and enter sports in the how you heard about us section. All right, Andy, let's get to some actual fun after we had to do the nitty gritty obligatory football finance talk. And the draft is upon us, and I actually love the draft. And one of my favorite things to do with the draft is to look back with a little bit of perspective and really dig into some of the draft picks that, with some time, with a little bit of space from them, really stand out. And I haven't really done this before. I've talked about some of these picks in passing, but never all at once. And what I asked you to do is to put together your 10 favorite picks of the last 10 years. And we can do these pretty quickly, but each one of them is probably going to have a little bit of a look into why that player matters in the scheme of today's NFL. So I guess the first thing, what's your first one? I mean, where do you want to start?
Well, I just went and marked all the picks that I like in the last 10 years. And by the way, you know how I assume you just went and read the former first rounders, maybe skimmed through second and third rounders and looked for names. Is that how you did this?
I pretty much did, but I went deeper than that.
Okay. Who was the first guy you had that jumped out at you like, oh my gosh, that's right, I forgot all about that guy? Like, not just as a good pick, like just as a guy, like a guy, most likely a bust, a guy that you completely just forgot existed.
Oh, it happens every single time I look at the 2009 NFL draft, which
right,
is
that was the year I had, yeah.
Oh, it's an awful wasteland of ridiculousness. It is the only draft I don't have a pick from on this list. And it's the draft where in the top 10, we have the likes of Jason Smith, Tyson Jackson, who's still in the league, Aaron Curry, Mark Sanchez, Andre Smith, who's not that bad, Darius Hayward-Bey, Aaron Maben, Larry English, Josh Freeman. It is rough.
Yeah, I wrote
at Grantland it might be the worst draft of all time.
Well, and maybe you wrote that in 2010 because 2011 is right on its tail with Jake Fisher and Luke Jokel and Deion Jordan at the top three. And then Lane Johnson.
That's 2012.
2013. What did I say? 2011? I meant 2013.
That's 2013. Johnson, 2011 is one of the best drafts ever.
Right. That's what got me mixed up. But those were the top three in 2013. Lane Johnson at four and Ziggy Ansah at five have been okay. Ansah's been better and okay. But then you get into Barcavius Mingo.
Oh, it is bad.
Jonathan Cooper. D. Milliner was number nine that year. Chance Wormack's number 10. Top QB was EJ Manuel. But the reason I asked you is because the guy for me that's like, oh my God, I totally forgot about him, was Aaron Curry, the number four pick. And I remember him that year because he was like deemed everybody's safest pick. Like what I've never understood, what does that mean, safest pick? I get what the people are intimating with it, but how do you know? And there's always guys that who are the two guys that become the safest pick? It's always kind of a nondescript linebacker or an offensive lineman, because people can never imagine an offensive lineman doing anything but panning out completely as expected, even though they probably pan out less than average at compared to other positions. But Aaron Curry for me is like, I guess you asked me my favorite, and I started with what became my least favorite because I just despise the idea of he's the safest pick. He's a can't miss. He's a 10-year guy. Nobody knows on any of this stuff.
I totally agree. And talking about the 2013 draft, I didn't include anyone from that draft. If there was somebody, it was going to be Tyrann Mathieu. But I just feel like he's been hurt a little bit, and it's a little too early for that kind of praise to be heaped on a draft pick. So I don't have any picks from 13 to now. I think that right now from the 2014 draft, the two guys that certainly have a chance are Derek Carr, if he turns into an absolute franchise quarterback as a second-round pick, and Trey Turner, who went in the third round. And in a way, I'll get into this later, but Aaron Donald kind of fits a corollary with some of the other players I have on my list, just as guys that are just so, so good. Anytime you can get them outside of the top 10, you probably stole them.
Okay, I get that. And so my criteria was going back and remembering what guys were who were making the picks, what they were up against. I'll start with my number one. You'll get an idea of what I mean by this. First of all, I have almost all first rounders on here because kind of subscribe to the idea that if you took a guy in rounds 3, 4, or 5 and he became a star, you didn't know he was going to be that good. So the pick wasn't great.
No, that's probably fair.
Like, and I get that there's value and you don't reach for guys. But like, for example, if Arizona knew Mathieu would pan out the way he is at character-wise and on-field-wise, they would have taken him in the first or second round. They wouldn't have gotten him in the
I've heard them talk about this, and they said that's not the case, really. It's just a matter
of where you can get him. Yeah, no, and I get that. There's a happy medium there. But overall, I guess if I have to pick one or the other, which I kind of felt like I did because we're talking who are your 10 favorite picks in the last 10 years – I limited more to first round selections because those are the riskier picks always because they're just such an investment.
Okay, I went a little bit off that, and I guess I'll start with my first one then. Antonio Brown was that 195th pick in the 2010 draft in the sixth round. And Antonio Brown is the best wide receiver on the planet. So I get where you're coming from with that, but in terms of value and everything else, you could argue that he's one of the best picks since Tom Brady.
Well, okay, yeah, of course, in terms of value. No, I get that. I have a wide receiver as my number one as well, and that's Calvin Johnson in 2007. And the reason why I did that was Matt Millen's, I believe it was his last draft. It was certainly one of his last drafts. And remember, he had picked a lot of wide receivers before in the top 10, and they had not panned out. And by this point, he's kind of known as a caricature. No one took him seriously. And I thought it took a lot of guts to go for another wide receiver and understand that this wide receiver really is different than the other four. And although it's going to make me look bad, there'll probably be a lot of jokes just because it's a receiver, I'm still going to do what I feel is best for the team. And Calvin Johnson panned out really well for him.
And it's not as if there weren't other options in that draft. It wasn't a de facto choice that you had to take Calvin Johnson. Joe Thomas went third. Adrian Peterson went seventh. there were a ton of good players in that first round. So it took even more balls to say, fine, I'm going to take another receiver. And he was right. I tweeted about this earlier tonight. That draft is absurd. You have the best player of the last 10 years, probably, at six different positions. Wide receiver with Calvin, offensive tackle with Thomas, running back with Peterson, linebacker with Patrick Willis, cornerback with Darrell Revis, and guard with Marshall Yanda in the third round, who was one of my 10 best picks.
Okay. Yeah, no, I wouldn't argue that. The only draft that I think could compete with it is the one you and I both think is remarkable, and that was the 2011 draft.
Do you have anybody from that draft?
Well, no, I have like the anti guy. I have Locker, Gabbert, and Ponder as the only guys I don't like from the draft. So, everybody else is like, it's implied they're all on by, like, they could go anywhere in my top 10, everybody else. And remember, by the way, Maze, the Cam Newton pick was not a foregone conclusion that year. That was a little bit of a risk by Marty Herney at the time, too.
I mean, that's a very good pick, but I still think even if it was a first-round pick, whatever, getting Watt at 11, J.J. Watt has three Defensive Player of the Year awards. He's been in the league since 2011.
J.J. Watt is on pace to be the best of all time as a defensive player.
Yes. So if you can get him at 11, that's absurd value no matter what. So that's why I have him as one of my 10.
Okay. So I have, as my number two, I have Andrew Luck, because you had to decide Luck versus Griffin. And sure, I think it would have been tempting to say, we're going to take the revolutionary player, we're going to redefine the NFL and take a guy they've never seen before. That's Robert Griffin, versus just taking the steady, very good in all ways and turned out to be great in all ways. We've seen the type of guy before, but that's a positive to me at the quarterback position, taking the proven type of commodity and Luck. I tip my hat to the Colts. I believe it was Ryan Grigson's first draft where he did that.
And I understand why you're saying that. And we've always thought Luck was the generational talent, but there was still so much buzz about Griffin at the time that it did take a little bit of commitment and a little bit of willing to stick to your guns to make that choice. I already did three, so who's your third one?
Gronk at number 42 in the 2010 draft.
I had that
draft
one too.
Yeah, because remember, he came in, he didn't play the year before. He had a back injury. So the Patriots were taking a flyer on him. And also that same year, you know, the Saints at 95 took Jimmy Graham. And if you go look at all the tight ends in the league, I think almost all the top 10, 15 or so were like second to fourth round type of picks. The tight ends have been found because the position has changed so much in the last few years. Because the formations are so much more versatile, rules are different, so big tight ends who can run are now more valuable, they're more unique. You find those guys in the middle rounds. Eventually that position will reset itself and the tight ends will start going in the first round again. Then they'll probably start being bust and we'll criticize everyone for it, right?
That's usually how it goes. It's all cyclical. Gronk was definitely one of mine. And then for my fourth one, I'm going to cheat and just do three guys from that 2010 draft, just later round guys. Graham is definitely in there. I mean, going as a third round pick, obviously there's a ton of value there. Bowman went four picks before him.
Navarro Bowman, you mean?
Yes. So as a third round pick, getting Navarro Bowman, I mean, you could have argued he was the best defensive player in the year in the league 2 years ago. So, I mean, that's obviously a ton of value. And then the other one from that draft that I love is Geno Atkins at 120. I mean, when you can get a guy who is a stud all pro every single year type player at the 120th pick in the draft in the fourth round, that's a pretty damn good one.
Yeah, I also had from that year Earl Thomas at 14. Because
okay, I like
there,
that one
there
a lot.
Are, yeah, there are people in the league who believe, and not everyone, not a lot, but there are people, meaningful people in the NFL who believe a safety is not worth ever taking in the first round because they don't pack the ball enough. They're too far away from the ball. And I get the logic of that, and a slot corner is probably more valuable than a safety in the aggregate picture. But there are also exceptions to every rule, and Earl Thomas is an exception to almost every rule.
I'm going to stick with that secondary, and one of the ones I did, again, this is a twofer, Richard Sherman in the fifth round in that 2011 draft, that's a pretty good one. I'd say that has worked out okay for the Seahawks. And then sticking in the NFC, sticking with fifth-round corners, Josh Norman was a fifth-round pick. So you look at what
those
two guys have done.
Yeah, but Mays, those teams didn't know what they had there. I mean, they didn't know those guys would be that good. The pick was good. It played well, and they developed. Norman, remember, was terrible his first two or three years. Sherman didn't play as a rookie. So is it a good pick or an incredible job of developing the pick and finding guys that fit what they do? And maybe that makes a good pick. They found guys they knew they could develop.
That's exactly what makes a good pick. I mean, you can develop guys that don't fit what you do and that would never have a chance to be good. Every team tries to develop everybody. I mean, just because right. You can develop a guy, I think that plays into whether or not it was a good selection. This is a draft and development thing. It has nothing to do with the talent.
Okay, I got you. So, and I don't disagree with that. I don't know what number we're on. My fourth one, I had Aaron Rodgers in 2005 because...
Oh, that's a really good one. I didn't go back that far. I stopped at 2006.
Okay. Well, yeah, because we were supposed to, I realized. Andrew Brandt told me the story of the Aaron Rodgers pick. Green Bay never had an intention to get him. When he fell to them...
I was there, too.
Oh, were you in the... when Brandt was telling the story?
Yeah. I was there.
Where were we?
Oh, he told us the story again at that tweet up. I don't know if that's where you were talking about it.
I think that, that was, it probably was in San Francisco.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, anyway, that's good drafting. That's good football that they got. They took a QB. Do you think a team would do that again today?
Oh, that's a really good question. I mean, what would be the team that, I mean, you could argue in a way that the Patriots sort of did that with Garoppolo. Sort of.
Yeah,
it was high enough.
Garoppolo was never – like, there were a lot of teams in the league that I think viewed Rodgers as the best QB in the draft.
That's a good point. I think a team would be smart to do it. I mean, like, if you're the Saints right now and you absolutely love Carson Wentz, you love him, and he falls to you at 12, why not?
Yeah. No, I would do that if I were the Saints. He's not going to fall to 12, but I get what you're saying.
So I think there are definitely opportunities for it, but teams just aren't willing to do it. I mean, honestly, if the Dallas does it at 4, it's a similar thing. It's not 24, but it's a similar thought.
Yeah, you're right, and they should do it at 4, by the way.
I agree. I think it's a prudent thing. You're never going to be that high again as long as Romo is healthy. So if you can plan for your future while you have a chance to, this blip of a season, I mean, it's similar when the Spurs – that 1 year they managed to get hurt enough and just enough things managed to go wrong and they got Duncan. I mean, they got the number one pick, so it wasn't like they had to make a choice either or, but it you don't get this opportunity very often is what I'll say.
Who's your number five guy on the list? Your number five favorite pick?
I'm already at 6 because I just did Norman and Sherman, so you're up again.
All right, let me catch up to you then. I have from the 2013 draft, Travis Frederick. Because Dallas had a plan. They wanted to build the O-line. They got ridiculed for that pick because people said, you could have gotten them later, which I'm not a big fan of the idea you could have gotten them later. I think to a certain degree, if you have a need and you see a player that fills the need, and by the way, teams do draft for need. It's popular to say, well, we take the best guy available. Almost nobody does that. You take the need because that becomes the best guy available to you. They saw that with Frederick, and they went out and did it, and it's paid enormous dividends for them.
I totally agree. I mean, I love the pick. You're never going to hear me trashing a team that picked an offensive lineman that turned out to be really good. My seventh one.
No, who's your sixth? Oh, Norman was your sixth?
I did Graham Bowman and Atkins, just like that 2010 stretch right there. I really like those. But my seventh one is probably the best one of this entire group. I mean, Russell Wilson at 75 is probably the best draft pick of the last 10 years. I think that's hard to argue with.
I get what you're saying there. In terms of return on value, return on the investment, Wilson has been the best in the last several years. I had at 6, I had Kawan Short because I like the strategy of taking Starlo Tulele and then taking another one right after that, and both those guys have developed. And that's another example. You talked about Norman and Sherman. That's an example of guys developing within the context of the scheme and within the context of what you do. And then my seventh is kind of along those same lines. Ryan Shazier for the Steelers. That Steeler defense is unique because it's built so heavily around inside linebacker play. There's fire zone coverages and their blitzes are all they're all built on inside linebackers. And Shazier is the most dynamic. I think remember they could have had C.J. Mosley that year. He went on the next pick to Baltimore. I think Shazier stylistically fits their system a little better than Mosley, who's another good player, but he fits their system better than Mosley. So I thought it was a nice job of identifying unique talent and then putting it to use. And he's gotten a lot better too with experience over these first two seasons.
What a fascinating 1-2. Because, and that's just this, like exactly like you're saying, it's such an example of guys getting in the right scheme. Because I think if you flip those two guys, Shazier is worse in Baltimore than Mosley is, and Mosley is worse than Shazier in Pittsburgh. But in Baltimore, question. I think Mosley is better than Shazier, and I think in Pittsburgh, Shazier is better than Mosley.
Yeah, I agree completely with you. And it's also it's another perfect illustration of teams drafting for need, or because the Steelers don't – they're like the Panthers. They don't draft corners very high. Go back and look. They've only taken two in the first two rounds since, I believe, 2000 when they took – I think it was Chad Scott, something like that. It's like in the last 15 years, they've taken two corners in the first two rounds. They always go with guys in the middle rounds because they – play these zones, and the zones change the throwing windows, and the key to the zones are having linebackers who can run. And so Shazier, with his long arms and his speed and his change of direction, he is a better fit than Mosley. And Mosley's probably a better first and second down player, which is what Baltimore values in its inside linebacker. So whenever we're going to hear the next few months, every team's going to say at some point, well, we just take the best guy on our board. That is such hogwash. Or if it is true, then it means their board is totally slanted for the team's style of play, as it should be. That's good drafting, and Pittsburgh's a great example of that. Mike, I have Jason Verrett later on this list as one of the picks I like, because I want to put him on the radar. I think he's a very underrated corner. If Pittsburgh had taken Jason Verrett, it would not only have not been on the list, it probably would have been a bad pick, because it would have been a waste of resources there.
Well, just throw out Verrett. I mean, I love Verrett. What is your thinking there?
Just because I thought he was as good as any corner in the league this year, watching the film week in and week out, and he guarded number one wide receiver. Like, he was a true number one shutdown type corner. So I wanted to put him on the list just to get people realizing Jason Verrett. I don't think he got a lot of recognition because San Diego as a whole was not very good.
I totally agree. And one of my least favorite questions at the combine every year is what professional guy do you think you play like? Because most guys have terrible answers and just say the best player at their position.
Right, but right.
My favorite answer from this year, which I thought was fascinating, is what Mackenzie Alexander said. Because he said Revis, which, okay, fine, of course you're going to say Revis. But then he said, I feel like I'm a combination of Revis and Jason Verrett. Which I think is a fascinating answer. Well, I don't know about you. Like, I was just like, oh man, that dude knows what he's looking for.
Yeah, and that's a good one to pick, because that implies that you are a pretty tactically advanced corner. Revis and Verrett are not the fastest guys. They're certainly above average, but they win by understanding angles and the nuances of receiver play. So, yeah, I get what he's saying. Hey, I'll give you because Verrett was my number 9, so I skipped my number 8, but he kind of falls along these lines, and he's not going to be on your list because you didn't do from the most recent draft, that makes sense. But Byron Jones for Dallas, I thought.
Really?
Because he is, for one, he's incredibly versatile, but for two, that's one. Two, I think corners are very valuable in the NFL. And three, nobody has guys that can cover safeties man-to-man right now. It's a big problem in the league because the corners have to cover the receivers most of the time. The linebackers are too slow, and most of the safeties are too small. And that's a problem that's only going
to
get worse.
Oh, to cover tight ends, you're saying?
Yeah, did I say safeties? I meant tight ends.
Yeah, tight ends.
Yeah, so Byron Jones is a guy that can cover the tight end. He covered Rob Gronkowski man-to-man very well back in week 5, I believe it was. And just stylistically, if you can – the defenses that have unique safeties in one way or the other, whether it's a Polamalu or a guy that plays in the box like Daylon Buchanan, they do things that other defenses don't do. And to have that creativity that you can have on defense is an enormous advantage, because – there are only 4 or 5 different coverages in the league, and there are only 4 or 5 different run fronts in the league. So anytime you can do something that teams don't see very often, that's a huge advantage. Offenses have all the plays in the world at their disposal. Defenses don't.
Well, I totally agree, and that's a fascinating choice, but I get exactly why you're saying it. My next one, a little bit weird. Carl Nix went in the fifth round in the 2008 draft. I think if you play Carl Nix's career out 10 times, seven of those outcomes, he's the best guard in the league for 10 years. But just what happened in Tampa with the MRSA thing and just the injuries, he just got so unlucky. And if you can get the best player at his position in football, which Nix was for a couple years in the fifth round, I feel like that's kind of a ridiculous steal.
I forgot about poor Carl Nix. I Googled him as you brought it up. Yeah, he's only 30 years old.
Yep.
And he did have a very nice career. Now, he probably looks at it this way a little bit. He did get paid at least, right?
Yes, he got that massive contract to go to Tampa Bay, which he deserved. I mean, he was that good.
Yeah. So, I'm glad for him, but I get what you're saying. Yeah, that's tough. The other guy who's a little bit like that, and also with Tampa Bay, was Davin Joseph, who was a first-round pick.
Yes.
And played like it, but then got injured. One other guy was – and we could probably do a whole podcast on these what-if guys, but John Beason, the year that Patrick Willis came out, Beason, what I thought was a slightly better linebacker at the time. Now, maybe I'd feel differently if I watched him on film today from that year, but – Beason, before he was hurt, was really, really good as well. There's a lot of guys.
I loved him.
You loved John Beason?
Yeah, I loved him. I mean, early in his career, he was one of my favorite players in the league. I mean, he was right up there for me.
Yeah. Yeah. Are we at 10? Who's your 10?
No, I mean, that's 8 for me. My 9th, another fifth-round pick, a guy who he's like the opposite of Carl Nix. If you played his career out 10 times, I think he hit the best outcome 10 times. And that's Kyle Williams, who was a fifth-round pick in 2006. I mean, that dude has had a really, really nice career for a fifth-round pick. Not even for a fifth-round pick. He just had a really nice career.
You know, we spent time at Buffalo back in this summer.
I heard, yeah.
And to a man, people within the Bills organization said by far the best athlete on their team is Kyle Williams. Apparently he's an unbelievable athlete and he's good at everything he does. He just happens to be in a kind of a fat guy's body.
He is. I mean, he went in the fifth round, but it's guys like that we see all the time. K'Juan Short isn't physically impressive. Jarrell Casey should not have been a third round pick, but he doesn't look good in spandex. And that stuff is always going to creep in. It's just always going to matter as much as it shouldn't.
Yeah. Well, and the problem is because for every Jarrell Casey, there's probably two or three bad body guys. Like, who was the guy that Saban yelled at? And Manny Wright. And he walked off the field crying a few years ago. Years ago. Yeah, it was Saban. Yeah, it was like in training camp. And Manny Wright, a rookie, a bad body guy, was out of shape, went on there, got yelled at, and left crying. Now, that's the extreme. Not every guy's going to sob and walk off the field. But the bad body guys, the bad ones ruin it for the good ones. And maybe that's just the way it's going to be always. I mean, what other walks of life does someone have a bad body and still, like, flourish unexpectedly?
I mean, me.
You're very good at what you do. You have a fine body. I've seen your body. You're not bad. You're fine.
Now we're getting into some weird territory here, but I appreciate it nonetheless. Have you done your 10 already? Who's your 10th one?
I've got one more, but why don't you do – you? Do you have one more or two more?
I have one more.
You want me to go?
Go ahead.
All right, and you're going to like this one because this kind of fits the pattern you've been following. I did go to the fourth round for this, and kind of a combo pick. I have Martavis Bryant as a 2014 fourth rounder, and then along a similar thread – he has a good body. It's just very little, which is why he was taken in the third round that same year. John Brown for the Cardinals.
Yeah, John Brown's a really good one. I like that one a lot. And strangely enough, for my last one, I'm going with what you did for the most part. I picked Kuechly at 9.
I mean, I thought about that.
It's 8 guys went before Luke Kuechly, and he's a dude who has been the centerpiece of a top 5 defense since he walked into the building. And those guys just don't grow on trees. And that draft was not good enough for you to pick 8 guys in front of him. That's all I'll say.
Well, and I think even getting him at 9, because were there other linebackers that year? I don't recall. What year did he was 20? What year was he?
2012. Yes, 2012. Yeah.
But Kuechly, I remember coming out thinking that he doesn't necessarily look the part, and this is going to sound wrong, but I think you're going to know what I mean, because he's an incredibly gifted athlete, like incredible. Yes. And but he's frankly small. He's a white guy. You know how many? Yeah, he's not a big guy, and he's a white guy, so he doesn't look like the athlete he is, which means you've got to really watch him neutrally on film. I think you got to really understand football and see the player rather than see the stereotype, which is hard to do if you're a guy picking a guy, if you're the one making these selections.
I agree. Would you say he is the second best defensive player in football right now?
Yeah, I would say that. And
I think so too.
To help the cause, at least there weren't a lot of other inside linebackers that year. So that maybe did help make it easier to select them, because I'm looking at who the next inside linebacker was. And Shane McClellan was picked, but he was not an inside linebacker coming out.
He was not.
And then at the in round one at pick 25 was Dante Hightower, who
it
a lot of
Michael
people
Kendricks.
Saw. Well, was he? You're right. Was he a few picks? No, Kendricks
was
the second rounder, I thought.
He was 46. I mean, it was 37
picks later. Okay, so Hightower was 25. So Hightower was the next.
Oh, Hightower. Okay, Hightower. I missed Hightower. Yep, that's correct.
But no, you could be right about Kendricks, because not everybody saw Hightower as a bona fide inside backer. In fact, he was kind of a tweener in a bad way. So I guess there weren't a lot of other guys to select. If you felt you had a need at middle linebacker, and we've talked about Carolina and how they build their team, and clearly they feel that's important, that position, then Kuechly probably was the clear-cut guy. It's still, though, I think you got to overcome the stereotype when evaluating him, and he makes it easier on you because he flashes on film so much. But I thought it was a tremendous pick overall. I agree with you.
And that draft, they got Kuechly and Norman, so not a bad haul. All right, man, I think that's all we got. We got to get out of here. This is a long one, but this was fun. I'm glad we did this. We should do more stuff like this.
I agree. We'll record a bunch of these and bank them, and maybe roll extras out during the week, because we could do this about any draft. In hindsight, everybody's smart in hindsight, right? We're going to look like geniuses every time.
Oh, of course. And that's the entire point of this podcast. So right now, if little programming note, we didn't want to record a free agency preview now because it's a little early, but we do know we need one. So I think the plan is going to be for us to record that later this week, roll it out for you guys a few days before free agency, so you have a chance to chew on it a little bit as free agency ramps up. I believe it starts at 4 p.m. on March 9th. So we're going to have something for you, but we want to have it early enough where you can listen before it actually starts.
Yeah, and two things on that. One, I appreciate you announcing it, because I, a few minutes ago, just emailed the editors asking for permission to do that, and now we get to ask for forgiveness to do it, because we've already said we're doing it, so it's out there. So that's good. It's always easier. And two, I thought free agency started later for some reason, so I'm going to be on a flight to Alaska when it kicks off. Can you believe that?
Wow, that's just terrible planning for you. It's a good thing I never go anywhere or do anything, so I'll be ready.
All right, this was fun, Maze. I appreciate it. We'll talk again then.
Of course, man. All right, talk to you guys later. Thanks for listening, as always.
Tip of the hat to Albert, another strong edition of MMQB. Did you know your favorite team has a daily podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network? Steelers fans, we have you covered with Locked On Steelers. Cowboys fans, it's Locked On Cowboys, and Chiefs fans, it's Locked On Chiefs. You get the picture. Search Locked On, your favorite team. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcasts Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.